the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
I just wanted to ask him a question. He proceeded to continue. And
did you check the status of the workers who were laboring on your
corpse? Of course, it's embarrassing, but more than that, I'm pretty angry about it.
Obama's messing things up.
Jews are good with money.
What's that?
Jews are good with money.
Okay, great. 877-876-PHIL. It's the world-famous Phil Hendry Show every night till 1 o'clock on the West Coast, 4 a.m. on the East Coast, the news, talk, and entertainment show that knows what it's talking about. Every night, through the looking glass we go and beyond, where truth is our bitch and where we go where no other talk show can go. They might decide they want to go to where we go. They can't go there. That's the beautiful thing about this radio show, and as I told a reporter for The Hollywood Reporter today, I was interviewed by a cat who was writing an article about talk radio, and he actually didn't even want to talk to me. I called him, and I said, if you're going to write an article about talk radio, you must talk to me. Otherwise, you have not, it will be an incomplete article. And so he did, and I said something, and I forget what it was, but it was pretty heavy.
Really?
Yeah. 877-876-PHIL.
Well, what'd you say? I mean, you can't just say that.
I don't know. It was something I forget. Oh, I know what it was. I said what we do on our show, no other talk show can do. And I said we seem to serve a segment of the spoken word talk radio audience that is really had it up to here with just the same political talk over and over and over again. I see there is a significant amount of people who are tired of that. And he said, well, do you think it's going to get bigger or smaller? I said, I think it's going to get bigger.
You said you think it's going to get bigger.
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, that's a Freudian slip. You went, oh, no, I think it's going to get bigger.
I didn't go bigger. I said,
no, but you did. You said, I think it's going to go smooth, and then bigger.
What? Yeah, all right, okay, so it was a Freudian slip. Maybe it'll get smaller, I don't know. As long as we can make a living, what do I care? God, 877-876-PHIL. Now, one of the stories we want to do here this hour, this is our news hour, Robert Leonard and Bud Dickman along the way. We wanted to you know, fulfill our promise, because I think this is an interesting article about blogs and the relative profitability of blogs. And who's making money with these blogs? Everybody blogs or thinks they can. Everyone somewhere along the line wants to write some kind of an online blog. Well, there is now, with this article, the 10 most profitable blogs, a list created by Newser and a website called 24/7 Wall Street and our own Jason Rantz, who is our show producer. And it's 24/7 Wall Street is out with its fourth annual ranking of the 25 most valuable blogs in America, with the caveat that valuation is as much an art as it is a science. Well, now, ain't that convenient?
What do you mean?
Well, you know, I really think it's fascinating. We live in a day and age where everybody wants everything mapped out right down to the last decimal, but then all of a sudden, well, you know, it's a little bit of an art. Everybody wants proof positive of this, that, something else. The value of many of the most significant blogs have increased in the past year as the economy showed some improvement and advertisers were willing to pay more to reach audiences online. All of the blogs on the, you know, what's going through our economy right now, folks, is a fundamental shift of a number of industries. Okay. I don't know, but it could be something as significant as the Industrial Revolution was. Now, certainly we're not seeing an entire agrarian economy suddenly shifting over into factories and urban production. Nothing quite that profound. But, you know, in a lot of ways, we are seeing the traditional workplace where people, for instance, would commute to being supplanted by the home office and the telecommute. And we're seeing large industries like in my business, broadcasting, where we had these plants, radio stations, networks, buildings with news offices and studios are being replaced now by the individual entrepreneurial radio show such as mine. One guy does news, another guy does a radio show, another guy does something else, Kim Commando, there's a weekend guy, everybody with their little studios, and they all link up when they need to link up to create a radio station. And that's pretty profoundly different from what we used to do. And we're also now taking a look in Detroit at how to make automobiles that will actually compete with some of the brands that have sold successfully internationally that are going to be, going to be the kinds of cars that we are going to want to buy because we're not spending an arm and a leg on fuel. We can't do it anymore. We don't want to do it anymore. We finally got the word, man. We finally got it through our heads. I ain't spending $5 a gallon anymore on any of this stuff, so you guys had better get with it. Oh, well, there's a big shift going on in Detroit. So it is in the world of information. The number one most profitable blog on the internet, according to Wall Street, 24/7 Wall Street, estimating blog audience size by considering several measurement sources, not all of which measure every blog on the list, but the number one blog they say is the Gawker network of sites. Gawker. Valuation, $240 million. You ready for that? Controlled by founder Nick Denton, it includes Gawker, Deadspin. Aha, who are we just talking about, huh?
Yeah, those are the guys that had Brett Favre's thing in a picture and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they did. Jezebel, Jalopnik, Gizmodo, whatever that is, Lifehacker, and several others. The Gawker Network, they claim that its combined sites have just over 20 million unique visitors. Audience research firms do not give any reason to doubt those figures, and they actually seem to be low. The sites have about 235 million page views a month. This is a network of sites owned by one guy, or controlled by the founder. They are their 2010 revenue is estimated to be $53 million. Now, that is a company that is not experiencing any kind of a recession. They're not laying people off. They're not downsizing. They're doing just fine. Number two, the Huffington Post. Valued at $150 million. The large news and information blog is more than 20 million and 7 estimates page views per month of 180 million. Attempts by the company's new management and sales staff to raise the quality of the site have worked. Huffington's revenue for 2010 will be close to $28 million. The company, however, is very expensive to operate and has an extremely complex publishing platform. The firm has more than 150 employees and many additional editorial contributors, some of whom are paid. Huffington management said the company would make money this year, and 24/7 numbers project a very modest operating profit. There's $28 million that they're going to pull in revenue. Now, that's the Huffington Post. That surprises the hell out of me.
Why?
Well, it's a very politically biased, or it was anyway, politically biased post. I mean, in terms of they are very liberal. You would say the Drudge Report is very conservative, but the Drudge Report is conservative in some of the stories. Most of the stuff that the Drudge Report does, most of it's just they just link news sites. And we come to the Drudge Report. Number three, $50 million the Drudge Report is worth. $100 million less than the Huffington Post. That, I'm telling you, that blows my mind. So Matt's business is worth $50 million. Drudge would be worth more, but its value is highly dependent on the fate of founder Matt Drudge. The site's unique visitors are higher than last year, up about 30% to 13 million. That may improve as the midterm elections near. Drudge posts its own figures for visitors on its homepage, but the numbers are ridiculously and inaccurately high, according to Wall Street 24/7. The quality of the site's advertising has risen. Based on 24/7 Wall Street's page view estimates, Drudge revenue in 2010 will be nearly $13 million. The company is very inexpensive to run, and the estimates of Wall Street 24/7 put operating income at $6.5 million after sales costs are taken into account. That's what it costs to operating income? $6.5 million. Number four is Pop Sugar Media, $40 million. I never heard of it. 14 million unique visitors a month the company delivers to a large audience and is only moderately dependent on its founders and is inexpensive to operate. Pop Sugar has more than 12 major branded sites, several of which target visitors outside the U.S., Revenue based on 24/7 estimates 11.5 million.
I never heard of pop sugar. Was that like for kids or some deal like that?
I don't know. Number five is McRumors, 37 million valuation. The leading site on all things Apple. The probably improve the quality of its advertising. What is that? The quality of its advertising?
Well, I mean, like if they got pop up or they got animated, you know.
Mm. Number six, the Cheeseburger Network, valued at $35 million. Did you ever think in your wildest dreams that you would be hearing about highly profitable blogs that maybe you've never heard of before in your life? Number seven is Perez Hilton, $32 million. Perez Hilton's site is valued at $32 million. The celebrity news site, which is an increasingly crowded field dominated by large media companies, has 6 million unique visitors a month. Advertising is sold by the Blog Ads Network. Revenue for the site is $5.4 million. Perez Hilton has an extremely small editorial staff and nearly no general and administrative costs. That's the biggest thing about the web revolution, that these companies are making enormous amounts of money compared to the overhead they have. So here's Perez Hilton. Is him? And how many guys do you think they have?
Well, he's probably got a guy that oils it up.
Will you shut up, man?
Come on, man. He'd probably have maybe a half a dozen to a dozen.
Probably. Then we have number eight is the SB Nation Network. Yeah, a network of blogs which covers nearly 300 teams. Oh, okay, so it's sports. Number nine is Funny or Die. That's Will Ferrell's site. Funny or Die, $24 million, a site that aggregates humor videos based on whether viewers think they are funny or should be killed. A cross between something and something and YouTube. Founded by a number of well-known comedians, including Will Ferrell, the site says Funny or Die has offices in Japan, Madagascar, and Bahrain, nine, which is probably horse dung, and nine full-time employees in Washington, and an elite private security force consisting of 400 soldiers. And six attack helicopters.
Really?
No, man, they're kidding.
Well, why would they put it on there if they're kidding?
Because they're kidding, Funny or Die. Are you kidding me?
Well, why do they need attack helicopters?
They ain't got any attack helicopters, man. They're joking, okay?
Yeah, but how do you know the value of a company if they're going to lie and tell you that they got a helicopter?
Look, dude, whoever values these companies, valuates these companies, doesn't take the word of the guy who runs the company. Oh, yes, we have attack helicopters and a force and a security force. They're going to look at it themselves, man. They're going to appraise it themselves. All right. So that's, and then number 10 is Mashable. Page views of 40 million, revenue 7.2 million, valued at 20 million, staff and freelance contributors close to 30. None of these places, with the exception of Huff, she's got 150 employees. None of them have more than maybe 20 or 30 employees. 877-876-PHIL. Coming up, Lawrence O'Donnell takes heat for a comedy made about Michael Steele. Lawrence O'Donnell is a former NBC Entertainment Television producer of West Wing and things like that. Now they've given him a show on MSNBC. In other words, he's an amateur, and he sounds like one. And we'll play it for you. Plus, you're going to see a bunch of Justin Bieber costumes this Halloween, like you needed me to tell you that. And don't forget our website, philhendryshow.com. We'll be right back.
Phil Hendry. Phil Hendry Show.
How many O'Donnell cuts did you say we had, bud?
Got four. The Lawrence O'Donnell and here. There's another one.
You don't have to stick it up in my nose, man. Are we supposed to have four Lawrence O'Donnell cuts or not?
Yeah, four Lawrence O'Donnell cuts. Yeah.
Well, we only got three.
No, I just gave you the fourth one.
You gave me the fourth one, and I loaded it into WaveCart, and we got three. Is it called O'Donnell? Is it called something else? 1, 3, 4. That's all I got. That's all I'll ever have. So I don't know what you did, man.
What I did? You're blaming me. I got the four there.
If you got the four here, how come I only got three? Three. T-H-R-E, three. All right, well, we'll just roll with it. MSNBC host apologizes to Steele for master comment. using the typical lack of humor and style and artfulness that characterizes the MSNBC amateur host, Lawrence O'Donnell had to apologize to Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele for not being funny, for not even being close to funny, for being some TV guy who was given a TV show to be a host, to entertain and go and make people laugh or whatever the hell he thinks he's doing. O'Donnell issued an on-air apology to Republican National Committee Chair. This has got nothing to do with politics, folks. This is just an ongoing commentary I do about the state of broadcasting, where some guy that was a producer on a TV show decided, well, you know, I'd like to be, would you like to do a TV show? Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, we'll stick you over on MSNBC because we don't want to lose you as a producer and a writer. You do really good episodic and entertainment programs. Well, okay, but if you want to keep me, I want to have my own talk show and everything about it and stuff like that. All right, fine. God, pain in the ass. All right, well, put him over on MSNBC. He'll get lost over there. Great. Well, he ain't getting lost. MSNBC host Lawrence O'Donnell had to apologize to Michael Steele after receiving a call Wednesday from Steele criticizing comments the host made on the previous night's show. O'Donnell, a former Democratic aide, said that Steele's real master is the RNC. Steele, an African-American, took issue with the suggestion that he was dancing for his massa. The interview was pre-recorded, so Steele did not hear the O'Donnell introduction during their chat. I called him back immediately and apologized for using the word he found offensive, O'Donnell said Wednesday night. Those of us who are not descendants from slaves can never know the full impact of the word master in the ears of an African-American man. Michael Steele told me it sort of stung. Kind of like when Keith Olbermann said that Michael Steele was self-hating. You people at MSNBC, I mean, no offense, but you talk about white boy. Just, I mean, you're about as white bread as it gets, and you cats like to talk the talk. Every time I flip on your channel, man, I'm looking at your pasty white pink faces.
That is true, man. I haven't seen any black man on there in many, many a year. And
when have you ever seen a black guy over there?
Because that one guy that's on ID and he's really good.
Yeah, he's dead, man.
Who?
That Harold Dowd guy?
Yeah, I love him.
He's dead.
He's dead? When did he die? I just seen him on TV just about 25 minutes ago or something.
He died back in August, man. He died of a heart attack.
Well, I can't feature that anymore. I get a good black guy, and he dies. They also got that Tamron Hall, but I only know that by reputation.
What do you mean?
Well, is it a man or a girl?
I think it's a man. No, I think it's a girl.
It's a woman. Tamron Hall's a woman. You just saw Harold Dowd 25 minutes ago. But yes, he passed on in August. He's a very good reporter. And yeah, he's very entertaining and great to watch on those shows. In fact, I put a little...
That would have been, I said R.I.P. Harold Dowd. Is that why you done that?
I did it on Twitter, yeah. Not that anybody knew what the hell I was talking about. All right, so conservative blog The Daily Caller poked fun at O'Donnell's apology because in the same segment, the host seemed to take pride that he apologizes when others don't. Oh, God. They wrote, isn't an apology where you express regret for making a mistake without at the same time smugly patting yourself on the back for being awesome enough to apologize? The goal, Mr. O'Donnell, is to never apologize because you know what you're doing and what you're saying at every moment that you are doing and saying it because you're a broadcast professional. That's the goal. That's the goal. Here is now, on his MSNBC show, The Last Word, Lawrence O'Donnell made comments RNC Chairman Michael Steele found offensive.
As the first congressional election during his party chairmanship approaches, Michael Steele is dancing as fast as he can, trying to charm independent voters and Tea Partiers, while never losing sight of his real master and paycheck provider, the Republican National Committee.
All right, so, you know, it's kind of like Lynch and a bunch of stuff like that, but if you're a liberal on a liberal-leaning or progressive network, you got to watch that, man. You aren't allowed to do that.
Yeah, that's the whole thing, man. Like a right winger can do it, and everybody just expect that.
That's right. Right wingers say master, and he'll say, well, I didn't mean that. You know, I meant something else. You say, well, you're insensitive. Why don't you quit being so sensitive? Whereas the cats over at MSNBC, they got to apologize. Send me cut two, will you, Rance? That's what I'm missing. That's what I've been missing. That's what we don't have. And that's what you didn't send. Cut two. I don't know what you just sent me, man, but I don't need it. All right. O'Donnell says he told Steele that he was very, very sorry for making those comments.
I called him back immediately and apologized for using a word that he found offensive. Those of us who are not descended from slaves can never know the full impact of the word master.
Is that
in
right?
The ears of an African-American man.
Thank you.
Michael Steele told me, quote, sort of stung.
And then he said, white man, if I ever see you after the sun goes down. All right, Chips actor Larry Wilcox goes from a cop to a real-life criminal. The world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Hoo-hee!
Phil Hendry. Listening to the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
World-famous Phil Hendry Show. The website is philhendryshow.com. Thousands of hours of archived material of the Phil Hendry Show. We have downloads there every day. We're making new downloads. We also have our daily show, a daily podcast of the show, our mini podcast, our classic Phil podcast, and, of course, every night, live video of our show, the live video cast and on-demand video. And if you've got a mobile phone, that is an Android or an Evo phone, you can watch mobile, you can watch our video cast, and soon we'll have it on demand for you if you have an iPhone, which is what I have. I've got the iPhone.
So you can't look at it. You can see on demand when they do it.
Yes, exactly. Now, I don't know, you know, what technology, you know, YouTube uses to make their videos available on an iPhone, and I don't know what technology some of these other people use to make their videos available on an iPhone, but that's what we're going to do. But as a radio website, as a radio show website, we're pretty far ahead of just about anybody, to be honest with you, in terms of what we got on the site. All right, three decades ago, the actor Larry Wilcox played Officer John Baker on the popular television show Chips. He was the guy that wasn't Eric Estrada.
Oh, yeah, that other guy, like a big redhead guy.
Yeah, I guess you could, maybe he had red hair, I don't know.
You can't really tell on account it was black and white.
No, it wasn't.
No, man, it was color.
Well, it wasn't good, though.
It was color. You know, I could tell the cat had sort of red hair.
Yeah, but it was almost like the quality, if you compare that, for instance, to...
Come on, bud, and let me finish the story.
Ah, man.
Just trying to give you background.
Larry Wilcox played Officer John Baker on the popular television show Chips, when you compare it to earlier color. But more recently, he'd been on the other side of the law, at least according to the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, before I read this story, and we all begin to salivate and clap our hands together and go, ooh, one of the guys that was on Chips may be a crook. Can I point something out to you? First of all, who's making the charge? The Securities and Exchange Commission. Who was in charge of overseeing whatever violations Bernie Madoff might have been responsible for? The Securities and Exchange Commission. Who dropped the ball when investigating Mr. Madoff, or the possibility of investigating Mr. Madoff, for almost 11, 12 years? The Securities and Exchange Commission. Who stood there with their thumb in their rear end at, oh, we didn't know until it was too late? You got it. So when the Securities and Exchange Commission says that Larry Wilcox, who used to be on Chips, may be responsible for this, that, or something else, I take it with a grain of salt. I don't know about you.
That's a good point, man.
Good point. I think it ought to be a standard operating procedure of life for all of us. When you hear Securities and Exchange Commission, you should just, like, go, you know, because Mr. Wilcox, who lives in West Hills, California, that's near Bobby Dooley.
Yeah, I was just saying, I looked it up on Google Maps.
He was among a handful of supposed penny stock promoters whom the SEC charged on Thursday with securities fraud, accusing them of various illicit kickback schemes. One of the schemes, the commission helpfully pointed out in the first paragraph of its statement announcing the charges, was perpetrated by an actor who starred as a police officer on the long-running television show Chips. Well, that's just fantastic, SEC. I bet you're real proud of yourselves that you're popping Larry Wilcox of Chips. See, I'm not going to I'm not going to take the bait. I don't take the bait. I'm not getting all giddy, and I'm not going to be at the water cooler tomorrow talking about Larry Wilcox of Chips. This is deadly serious business, and this is the SEC that had its thumb parked all those years when Bernie Madoff was making off with the store, with the cash register, with the furniture, with everything. According to the SEC, you know, what is it with you? What do you mean one of them is a guy that was on TV? Why don't you just report the facts, okay, Jack? The facts.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Exactly. According to the SEC, the story of Mr. Wilcox's scheme begins one fine afternoon when a Florida man named Anthony Maloney, sure his name's Anthony Maloney, sounds suspect already. Very, very ethnic, if you know what I mean. Anyway, I'm kidding. No, according to the SEC, the story of Mr. Wilcox's scheme begins with a Florida man named Anthony Maloney, who was the chief executive of a purported holding company named TriStar Holdings. I've heard of them.
Yeah, man, they got that horror. Don't they do TV?
I don't know, but I have heard of them. Anyway, it's called TriStar Holdings. I have heard of them. In 2008 and 2009, well, you know, Wilcox is an actor, so I guess it's possible. So anyway, in 2008 and 2009, the commission said Mr. Maloney gave kickbacks to a purported employee pension fund trustee who in reality was an undercover FBI agent. In return for the trustee's purchase of tens of millions of restricted shares of TriStar stock. Liking the way the arrangement worked out, Mr. Maloney told Mr. Wilcox and another California man with a supposedly corrupt trustee and arranged for them to replicate the scheme for the dirty, no good with their own companies, with Mr. Maloney serving as the middleman, the SEC said. Understand, you guys ain't got a whole lot of credibility. Mr. Wilcox proceeded to pay kickbacks for two purchases of $800,000 in restricted shares of the UC Hub Group, a California company for which he serves as president and chief executive, according to the complaint. The SEC said the company claimed to be in the mining, energy, and global web television business.
Yeah.
Anyway, a lawyer for Mr. Wilcox did not immediately return telephone messages because he didn't want to talk to some pain in the ass from the New York Times who wasn't going to write an objective story, not even close. And why waste his time with a jackass that's out to get his client? Thank you.
What do you think about it?
You know what I think about it? I think that's the SEC's version, and we'll find out what happened. Maybe they're right. Maybe these guys are, maybe they're dirty. But, you know, $800,000 worth of shares. No, it was 800,000 restricted shares. And the money that they're talking about, tens of millions, and I understand that they've got to continue to do their job. The SEC sues people. They do not arrest people. The SEC sues people. They do not arrest people. So if they find that a criminal complaint has been sworn out, and the SEC can certainly go to the district attorney in Los Angeles and say, we have evidence of a crime here, that is evidence of something that violates the criminal code, well, then Mr. Wilcox and friends have an even bigger problem. But right now, what the SEC is probably going to do is sue these guys, civilly claim against them. The LA Times is citing a story by the South Florida Business Journal saying Larry Wilcox has agreed to settle criminal charges. Okay, well, there you go. They're the only source reporting the development. Larry Wilcox, the former Chips TV star accused of securities fraud for manipulating penny stocks, has agreed to settle criminal charges in the case. Wilcox reached a plea agreement with the U.S. Attorney's Office for Southern Florida on July 2nd, according to a copy of the agreement obtained by the South Florida Business Journal on Thursday. He could face up to 5 years in prison.
Yeah, so much for you saying that they didn't, that they don't.
Okay, you're right. But I'm just telling you. All right, so they, you know, they were right. Or maybe they're not right. Maybe this guy's having to cop a plea because he can't afford a lawyer. Maybe they, you know, who knows? But I'm just telling you, when it comes to the SEC, I'm not going to be sitting there going, well, aren't they doing just a great job? So go talk to somebody else, man, if you want to hear that.
Yeah, but I mean, they're doing their job, man. You can say they didn't do their job when it come to that guy Madoff, but now they're doing their job. Can't you give them credit for that?
Give them credit for what, man? You tell me they're doing their job. Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, how do I know they're doing their job? They were supposed to be doing their job with Madoff. Now they're making noise about this, that, or something else. Look, dude, I get all kinds of RSS feeds every day, just like you guys. I get a feed from the FBI. I get that FBI feed. All right? I look at all kinds of stuff the FBI's doing, and they're busting people left and right. They're busting cats. Mortgage fraud? Oh, my God. You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe the stuff the FBI's digging up with people that are engaged in selling, creating out of whole cloth mortgages. I ain't never seen the SEC involved in any of them. Not that they'd be involved in real estate, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but why can't you give them credit for doing this?
Because it's chicken crap. Because the only reason why it made the news is Larry Wilcox is a guy that was on chips. It's chicken crap. They should have been minding the store, man, and they didn't. The other story here, because Bud wanted me to do this because he thinks Lou Dobbs is a great guy. I do too, Lou. You are a great guy.
Lou Dobbs is bitching. And that one time that I got to meet him, he is nice and everything.
He's a nice guy. Lou Dobbs, except he's a bigot. I'm kidding, Lou. I'm just joking around. Lou Dobbs used illegal immigrant labor. That's what the report said, and it turned out it was horse dung because I was reading up on this morning. In fact, Dobbs had this woman on his show who made this charge. Now, listen to this. Former CNN talk show host Lou Dobbs, who is known for his hard line on illegal immigration today, denied that he has ever hired illegal immigrants. And I'm going to tell you something else. He brought the woman on the show who made that initial report and asked her point blank, have I ever hired illegal immigrants? So listen to the story. I never have, nor has the Dobbs Group at any time hired an illegal immigrant.
What's a Dobbs Group?
That's probably the name of his company or something.
Is that the Dobbs Group? Is that the name of his family?
Yeah.
No, that's his company, the Dobbs Group.
What's that mean? Is that like company?
Yeah, man. Some people call it company.
No, like your company, man, Henry Radio.
My company's Henry Radio, yeah. His is the Dobbs Group.
It sounds very gay or something. Something about it disturbs me.
That's fine, bud. Thank you very much. And you too, Robert, for weighing in.
No, I just thought it was the Dobbs Group. It sounds almost like a cult.
It ain't no cult, man. It's the way some companies are called. Just hold on for a minute. Dobbs was responding to a cult.
Well, that's what it sounds like.
Dobbs was responding to a story in The Nation magazine, now listen, alleging that he has relied for years on undocumented labor for the upkeep of his multi-million dollar estates and the horses he keeps for his 22-year-old daughter, that he relies on undocumented labor. Now, naturally, it being The Nation, they're going to emphasize the fact the cat's got money and he has horses for his daughter, which automatically means he's a criminal.
It does?
No, it doesn't, bud. What I'm saying is when people read that, oh, they're going to resent the rich guy, so he must be doing something illegal to make all that bread. Hello, the guy's in TV, or was. The story in the liberal magazine alleges that at least five undocumented immigrants worked in Dobbs' gardens and in stables where his family's horses were cared for. Dobbs, who called the story a fairly typical hit piece, a smear piece, interviewed the reporter behind the story, Isabel McDonald, on the radio show. He repeatedly asked McDonald if he or his company had ever hired illegal immigrants. All right? Now, in an interview on the Lou Dobbs show with Isabel McDonald, the author admits that Dobbs contractors used undocumented labor, but not Dobbs himself.
You and the Dobbs Group have relied on the labor of exploited, undocumented workers for years. You have had undocumented workers looking after your horses, looking after the grounds of your estates. And the Lou, the buck stops here. Did you ever...
Well, wait a minute, Isabel. You don't get the right to just keep talking and filibustering. I am now asking a question again. Did I or any company I own at any time hire an illegal immigrant of any kind? That's a yes or no question.
Contractors did.
Okay, so here is the next segment. Dobbs refers to the author as a native. I don't know what that means, but the point is that Dobbs, she said no, was the answer. That's a bad piece of sound. Here is something.
Did you check the status of the workers who were laboring on your horses and on the grounds of your estate?
Now, this may shock you because, Isabel, you now sound like a nativist and a person willing to exceed the law because I have no standing, nor do you or anyone else in this country, in law other than Immigration and Customs Enforcement, in point of fact, and those working under 287G to go after the status of any one of these people.
The point is, Dobbs busted her when she said that, you know, he was responsible for hiring illegal workers, and she said, no, you weren't. She admitted to that. He called the story a hit piece. Dobbs, who was calm throughout the interview, you can hear that, responded that he does not have the standing to check the status of anyone, and said McDonald sounded like a nativist for asking him to do so. He insisted that he wanted to have a friendly conversation with McDonald, despite her outrageous claims, and said she was trying to deflect and avoid his questions. We'll be back. World famous Phil Hendry Show.
This is the world famous Phil Hendry Show. This is the world famous Phil Hendry Show.
What?
Nothing. 877-876-Phil. Well, this is Friday morning, man, so the weekend is ahead of us. And I thought I would do this before the week is out. This is the story that you like?
Yeah, is this the one? Oh, this is bitching.
Yeah, well, I want to know if that's really true, though.
Well, according to the story in the Telegraph, and this is the one that Bud wanted me to do last night, we didn't have time, human waste used to power homes in Britain. Human waste used to power homes in Britain. All right.
If we could do this in America, it'd be great.
Well, I don't know why we can't. Human waste is being turned into renewable gas and used to power homes for the first time. A pilot project run by Centrica in a plant at Didcot Sewage Works, Oxfordshire, is the first in Britain. What, Robert?
How come they got like five different names? I live in Centrica in Oxfordshire. You know what I'm saying?
I don't know, man. It's just the way they do things, okay?
Yeah, I knew this guy. I live in Wiltshire, in Oxfordshire, on Thames River, you know, zip code 342 or something.
Okay, so they got their own way of doing stuff.
Yeah, in Canada, they have a zip code like Z.
All right, well, let me finish this. I don't know. They do that in Canada. They do a lot of stuff in Britain. It's weird. I don't know, man. You know?
They are just one name of a town. Where do you live? I live in London. Zip code, you know, whatever.
London zip code, what? They ain't got no zip code. They got some postal code or something. A pilot project run by Centrica in a plant at Didcot Sewage Works, Oxfordshire, is the first in Britain to produce renewable gas from sewage for households to use. The waste is stored for 18 days and then turned into domestic gas, which will supply about 200 homes with power. The scheme sees sewage arriving at the Didcot Works for treatment, and then sludge, the solid part of the waste, is further treated in a process known as anaerobic digestion, in which bacteria break down the biodegradable material and creates gas. The gas is cleaned before it's fed into the gas grid in a process which takes around 20 days from lavatory flush to being piped back into your house.
That's nuts, man. I'll flush a toilet in 20 days. It's going to heat the house, Robert. What do you think of that?
I can't wait to have my next bowl of chili.
All right, fine. Ha, ha, ha. Anyway,
what about the smell, though, man? Your house going to stink, especially your house.
No, your house will smell worse.
No, you clowns. Did you hear what I was saying? They break this stuff down with bacteria. They break it down to the point where it becomes a usable, actual, you know, powering gas as opposed to somebody's crap.
Don't smell like a fart?
No, dude. I mean, let me ask something. How commercially successful is that going to be?
Well, man, if this saved money, I would do it if it was my own dump.
You'd want to smell your own gas, huh? Piping into your house?
I wouldn't mind it.
Grow up, okay? Just grow up. The project is a joint venture between Thames Water, British Gas, and Scotia Gas Networks. And yeah, I'll bet they got a gas network, man.
Yeah, everybody in Parliament, or whatever they call it.
Anyway, energy experts believe that 15% of all gas consumed could come from human waste, sewage slurry, and food thrown away by households and supermarkets. It is hoped that if successful, the pilot project could be rolled out across the country.
Well, look, everybody knows, and everybody knows, from the time you're a little tiny kid, and how come they have not figured this out, I don't know. But from the time you light your first fart, you know.
All right, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly right, man. The first fart I ever lit is like a blowtorch. And it,
okay, man, I get it, all right?
Yeah, well, how come they can't figure that out?
Well, I guess they're figuring it out now.
Seriously, the first fart that I ever litted, what?
Will you let me finish this, man, and we can go down memory lane about the farts you guys light?
I lit one, man. It was like a damn... I'll never forget it, man. It was a Tuesday night.
And will you...
Sorry.
However, there are concerns that the investment is not there, as it is more expensive to produce renewable gas known as biomethane. Geroid Lane, Managing Director of Communities and New Energy at British Gas, said the renewable gas project is a real milestone in Britain's energy history and will help consumers and the environment alike. However, I won't go near it because I won't put the money into it because I can't make any... No, he didn't say that. So we'll see what happens. Charles Wagon, our technical director, Dan Northcraft, our associate producer and screener, and our executive producer, Jason Rantz, the world-famous Phil Hendry Show here each and every night. And don't forget, philhendryshow.com, philhendryshow.com, downloads, podcasts. We have our on-demand video casts of each and every show, the only radio show worth looking at. In fact, tonight, you could have seen me crawling around on the floor putting paper into the printer. Have a very pleasant good morning from the El Pacifico.
Phil Hendry.